Welcome to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and all this week, we're sharing some of our favorite history conversations we've had on the program. Later this hour, a conversation with the creators of an oral history project about the partition of British India, and the story of Albert Lee, whose work to help some of the U of I's first Black students earned him a reputation as the unofficial dean of African American students. But first...
Fellow delegates, the people of America are watching us now. As indeed the whole world is watching us.
In that archival audio from YouTube, Julian Bond is addressing the inside of the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. But it's those cries from protesters outside that are foremost in people's memories from that summer 51 years ago in Chicago. It's where discontent over the course of American politics, both at home and in the Vietnam War, drew 10,000 protesters to Chicago. Marcia Barrett is a professor of history at the U of I. Rick Hogan is a veteran columnist and journalist at the Chicago Tribune. And I spoke with him last summer on the 50th anniversary of this. Rick was actually a teenager at the time. And I started by asking him what it was like in the days leading up to that convention.
Well, because I lived in and was with my parents, of course, in Old Town as a teenager, I was sort of privy to what was going on a few blocks east in Lincoln Park. And, as a curious kid, I would wander over there and see, wait a minute, why are all these people seemingly living in Lincoln Park? That is where many, many, many of the protesters who arrived in Chicago without any other place to stay had decided to sort of camp. And I think the night that they got kicked out, which I think was the night before the convention started by the police department, is really, really what kind of sparked everything that followed. Had they been, and an old mutual friend of ours, Abe Peck, a former professor at Northwestern, who was then the editor of The Seed, had been petitioning to allow people to sleep in the park past the curfew, and got rejected and rejected and rejected by Daley. And then Daley moved in the cops to move everybody out. And it was that night was absolute chaos that actually rivaled the night of the 28th in front of the Hilton.
Marcia, can you set for us the context of all of this? Rick is also talking about the immediate spark to this. But 1968, when we look back on American history, we're not just talking about the escalation of the Vietnam War. I wonder if we can go back a couple months prior to the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, and then before that, the assassination of Dr. King?
Right. You really can't overstate how tumultuous the year was, 1968. Earlier in the year, President Lyndon Johnson shocked many people in the nation when he announced that he would not run for re-election. And then on April 4th, you had the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. 2 months later, the assassination of Robert Kennedy. The nation was in shock, certainly, the Democratic Party in particular. But also after the assassination of King, you had urban unrest, also known as riots, in over 100 cities across the country in April of 1968. And Chicago was one of those cities. So when we think about the tension in the city and the police and National Guard sort of preparation for the convention, we have to think that just a few months prior, you had a huge amount of violence that took place in Chicago. And there's already a lot of tension because of that. And then you add this growing discontent over the Vietnam War, and you end up having this really tense situation. And you have Mayor Daley, who is determined to demonstrate that he has control over the city, law and order, as he called it. And, you know, this sort of creates this very tense situation that delegates entered into when they came to the city of Chicago.
And Rick, what was that like with Mayor Daley and the police?
Well, that's very well put, because I think the tumult and fires and rioting in the wake of the assassination of Dr. King is what put the cops who were out there. And we have to remember, this is 50 years ago. They were out there, and I'm not defending them, but they were out there with no bulletproof vests, with no rifles, with no radios. That was life-altering for these people, many of whom at the time, including Ed Burke, the longest-serving alderman in the history of the city, it made them unbelievably tense, because Daley's whole notion, he was fearful that the riots would start to engulf the city. And because Chicago has a kind of natural moat, his plan was to put up all of the bridges across the Chicago River to prevent people from invading downtown. I cannot even imagine what the kind of stress that was involved for the cops, as sad and tragic as it was. These guys, all of them, and women, what few women were on the force then, were terrified. And I think you're very, very right that made all police officers and National Guard people in Chicago increasingly tense as we got up to the convention. I cannot punctuate that more forcefully. I think that contributed greatly to the chaos and the energetic attacks against the kids.
And Rick, I wonder if you can describe a little bit like what the convention. So at this point in time, you are a teenager, but you were you doing a little bit of work for the Sun-Times?
Yes, I was sort of a glorified copy boy manning the phones and running errands for the reporters from the Sun-Times and the Daily News who were headquartered in the basement of the Hilton Hotel on Michigan Avenue. Mm. I did, the day before the convention, get to go down and see the amphitheater on the south side, 43rd and Halsted, where the convention was going to be held, and where there was great fear that people would protest around there. Impossible. It was like, it is unlike anything I've ever seen in the city of Chicago. It was like a guarded camp. Barbed wire for a square mile around the amphitheater were various checkpoints with barbed wire and National Guard people with rifles and Chicago police officers. Just getting to the amphitheater was nightmarish, I thought. And I think, I'm pretty sure I hazard to say that many delegates coming to Chicago, ooh, what a fun town, were shocked and appalled by that.
And Marcia, the irony of all of this, as we're remembering this is the Democratic National Convention. This is supposed to be a celebration of democracy where the party picks their president. I wonder how much of the, I mean, at the time, I think we look back on that with so much irony, but I wonder what the sense was in the moment of just this convention and how important this 68 convention was for the Democratic Party.
Well, I think that point about delegates arriving, right, and trying to enter the amphitheater and seeing the barbed wire and all of the soldiers, I think that, I mean, that had to make a real impression on, on the delegates, but also the sense that, that all of this effort is needed to sort of remove delegates from rank and file and activists. Who they hope to really incorporate into the party, I think must have been very striking, even though at that point it was still customary for party professionals to have a really tight control over Democratic conventions in this time period. It's sometimes described as a bunch of middle-class white men sort of monitoring this choreographed good time. But even for those who are accustomed to that, it must have been shocking.
And Rick, what was it like? So then I wonder if you can explain for folks how everything sort of broke down. You set up the beginning of the chaos, and that was that there were, maybe 10,000 people who had come to Chicago, quite a few thousand of whom were even more than that, you think?
There were some locals, I think, and I think, the other thing about it as an observer of it, I mean, there were also a lot of curiosity seekers. I knew people, especially on the Wednesday night that things exploded, the 29th here, when the real whole world was watching.
That was outside the Hilton.
That was right outside the Hilton when thousands of people tried to storm. I don't know if storm's the right word, but tried to get into the Hilton, and the police were there. I never forget standing behind a line of police. I was inside, standing behind a line of police in my father's old Marine Corps jacket and being looked at suspiciously because I looked much more like the kids in the street than I did the police officers. And I think what happened and this is one man's observation, is that there was a lot of nastiness on both sides. There were ashtrays flying from windows in the Hilton. They were throwing down at police. There were things being thrown at cops. And all of a sudden, the cops seemed to overreact, and batons came out, and people scattered, and the air was filled with the saddest screams and bodies running and falling and blood. It is, in a sense, it was kind of, and I hate to use this kind of the comparison, but it was like sort of the worst barroom brawl for any of your listeners who know what a bar, how that kind of erupts. It simply erupted. It was disorganized chaos, and to anybody observing, and again, there were a lot of people down there who, you know, sort of actually had no business being down there. They were not police officers or National Guard folks or protesters. They were just curious, and a lot of those curious people got roughed up too. It was
and journalists,
wild,
right? Because there was also
that
famous
sure.
video of Dan Rather getting on the convention floor, getting, as he says, belted in the stomach. And
well,
so all of this is also, right, Rick, all of this is being broadcast to all of America. And, you know, this is the beginning of everyone really watching all of this. This is all being broadcast on TV. People are listening on the radio. I wonder, Marsha, let me ask you, what impact do you think this had? How did this change the Democratic Party?
You could point to a lot of different things in terms of the impact on the Democratic Party. But immediately, you do see a distinct difference in the 1972 convention. You had McGovern-Frazier reforms where the Democratic Party establishment decided that there needed to be some change, that there would be more democracy, you could say, in the Democratic National Convention. So there was already an effort amongst young people, Black people especially, women, to be able to get more control over the Democratic Party before the 68 convention. But afterward, you start to see this momentum build. So there, I mean, just for an example, 5% of the delegates at the 1968 convention were Black. In 1972, it was 15%. I think there were 40% of the delegates in 1972 were women. That was triple the number of 1968. So you start to see more representation within the Democratic Party, where delegates begin to look more like Democratic voters, and the process of choosing delegates becomes more transparent. And these are efforts that were made to try to prevent this feeling on the convention floor that delegates and party establishment really had no connection to the voters and activists and issue-minded voters who weren't just willing to accept whoever the Democratic Party or the party professionals nominated. They wanted someone. They wanted to have a say. And you do see an immediate shift. One could even argue that Jimmy Carter, his nomination, winning the nomination in 1976, was due in part to those reforms and the inclusion of a more diverse delegate body in 76.
Mm. We just have about a minute or so left. Rick, I wanted to ask you how you think this changed not just Chicago, but maybe even a generation of Americans, maybe even yourself included, witnessing
you know,
this?
I think it changed me in some sort of quiet ways. I certainly identified even at 16, you know, I wanted the war to stop. But I also think we have to remember that war, protest or no protest, went on for 7 more years, and countless thousands of young men mostly killed. Daley was indeed in Chicago and across this nation more popular than he had ever been, because I think the prevailing attitude, as much as we like to think this was a kind of us against them thing, most Americans did not even come close to feeling a part of the anti-war movement. It was these long hairs. The cultural clash was severe. Daley kept winning. Daly.
Right, because he was the
mayor.
Law and order, right? And that's...
That's right. It's like these kids, I think a lot of people, a lot of, certainly not I, but a lot of people thought, look at these spoiled, long-haired college, dope-smoking college kids. Good. Bust them in the head. And I really do believe it took years to overcome that, I think.
Right. Unfortunately, we're out of time, Rick, but I want to thank Rick Hogan, veteran Chicago journalist. He's with the Chicago Tribune, historian Marcia Barrett, for being with me. Both of you, thanks so much. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. More than 70 years ago, British India was divided into two separate states, India and Pakistan. This came to be known as partition. Massive numbers of people scrambled to try to get to the new majority Hindu and Muslim countries, and in the process, the resulting violence killed an estimated 2 million people and displaced many more. Today, modern-day South Asians want to make sure those personal stories of that time aren't lost to history. The 1947 Partition Archive Project has collected more than 4,000 interviews from people all over the world, including a few from right here in Illinois. Rohini Ramkrishnan is the digital archive manager of the 1947 Partition Archive. I spoke with her about this in the summer of 2017, and I started by asking her why and how this project got started.
Well, Nyla, the 1947 Partition Archive is a nonprofit oral history organization, and we got started in about 2010 the founder, Dr. Gunita Singh Bhalla, realized that there was no existing single source of primary witness accounts of the partition, despite the huge impact that it had had on human life in the subcontinent. Mm-hmm. The displacement is the numbers displaced by the partition are huge. About 15 million people are estimated to have been displaced, and 2 million people are said to have lost their lives. And despite this, you know, unlike the way the Holocaust has been documented, or the disaster at Hiroshima and Nagasaki has been documented through oral history projects, nothing like that existed for partition at the time. So the archive was established to solve this problem.
And I think, as you mentioned, with those other tragedies, one thing that stands out to me is that lots of young people whose parents or grandparents experienced what for many was very traumatic events don't hear too many stories about them because they're difficult to talk about. And I wonder for you, did you grow up hearing stories about this, about partition?
Well, my family personally was not hugely impacted by the partition, but the partition in South Asia is a living legacy. You know, it's something that the people in the subcontinent live with every day, and it's affected the relationship between India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh since 1947. But despite the living legacy of the event, it's not been taught very well in schools. The focus of the narrative, of historical narratives surrounding partition, has been on the reasons for why partition happened. The focus has been on political leaders, but very little has been talked about the human impact, despite it being the lived experiences of people in the subcontinent.
I wanted to play some of the audio that we have from two of the people who were interviewed for the project who now live in Illinois. And one of them is Sarabjit Rundava, who lives in Evanston. His father worked for the British government right up to partition, and he was trying to get from Lahore to Amritsar to meet up with the rest of his family. But at this point, making even short trips was getting really dangerous. And Sarabjit said that his father never talked about this, but here's what his mother said to him, or told him about it.
So my dad's orderly was a Muslim person. And my orderly knew the way around Lahore pretty much a darn sight better than my father. So he led him through the back streets. They went to the train shuttling yard. And my mother told me that what the orderly did was he was able to lash my father under the train. And so I presume that my father must have found some reasonable place under the train where at least he could get some foothold. Mm-hmm. But he was tied up with a rope, mm-hmm, so that he didn't slip down
Mm-hmm. And essentially killing me.
That was Subrajit Rundava. That's a really incredible story, Rohini, talking about how his father, his story of how he was snuck through Lahore and tied by rope to the bottom of the train just so he could get to Amritsar safely. And I think for a lot of people who aren't directly affected by this, it can be really hard to comprehend what it was like for two separate countries to be created at the stroke of midnight, millions of people trying to get to new places all at once. Can you just explain for people who aren't familiar with the history how much notice people had beforehand? Sort of how did this all come about?
Rumors, I think one thing we learned from interviews in the field that we've conducted is that there were rumors surrounding partition for a very long time. And an announcement was made on the radio, and some people, have recollected memories of hearing that announcement, saying that that the countries were going to be, that Pakistan was going to be an independent country for a Muslim majority. But I think, despite the official announcement, before and after the announcement, there were rumors spreading, and that created confusion and also panic.
And what, we just heard Surabjit's story. In a minute, we're going to get to another gentleman, Yogeshwar Sharma, talking about how to get on the train and how dangerous it was. What was it like for people who are trying to migrate? Were people mostly trying to do this by train?
Well, there's different ways that people migrated across the borders. Migration by train was a big way for people to travel, and we've heard some very difficult stories narrated by partition witnesses of some very violent journeys. We've heard of people speaking about going to receive families at the railway stations, only to see that the trains arriving are full of bodies, massacred bodies in the compartment, We hear stories like this, and so there were migrations by train, but people also did migrate by road in long caravans. So you'll find old photographs of people in very long processions migrating in what they call kafilas. People also migrated by ship, when it was from port cities like Karachi to Mumbai. And the more privileged people, people at the time were able to maybe fly out as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're responsible for managing all of these stories digitally. You've done some of these interviews yourself. I wonder, as you think about some of the conversations you've had, what surprised you? What's most surprised you as you've been hearing these stories?
I think the stories that we record, while we ask people to narrate their partition experiences, the stories we ask people to also speak about their life stories. The interviews span the entire life story of a person, right from their earliest childhood memories up until the present day. And I think what stands out to me is the descriptions of life, before partition, life in the different cities and towns and villages before partition, the different kinds of descriptions that we get, maybe a city, like Lahore, how it was at the time, being very cosmopolitan, and people talking about their different friends. So I think that always stands out to me. But in terms of something that I think the most powerful accounts are definitely the migration experiences and the varied experiences that people had, in refugee camps during their travel, during their journeys. I think those do stand out.
I wondered if we could hear a little bit from another Illinois resident who was interviewed for this project. Yogeshwar Sharma now lives in Naperville, just outside of the city of Chicago. He was only 4 years old when partition happened. But here he talks about what it was like after partition and how his mother wound up taking care of his cousins and so many others in his extended family who lost their parents.
She tell my cousin, you go, he's not coming. Now, because my cousin had no mother, because my aunt, she died in Pakistan, maybe in the late 40s. So my mother took care of my cousin family too. Mm-hmm. And he will just leave, then I have to leave too, because otherwise the teacher will beat you, But those are the days I still remember like it happened yesterday. Mm. And I tell you, it still makes me cry.
That's Yogeshwar Sharma, his story, Naperville resident, for the 1947 Partition Archive. It's an oral history project that we're talking about, a reminder of when British India was divided. Rohini, I mean, when you hear that and you hear it, obviously, as you've just been saying, there's so many of these stories are so emotional. These interviews are 1 to 2 hours long, maybe even more. What do you think are there common themes about the ripple effect that this had on families that have emerged and sort of things that you think are important for people to understand?
Absolutely. I think one thing that we've seen, you know, across many interviews is that the people who experienced partition at the time were forced to leave their home for a new place and leave everything behind, you know, leave their homes, leave their belongings, and lose many family members or friends. Many of them described that they always thought that they would return, that they would always return to their homeland or their village or town that they were from. They never thought that partition was permanent. They never thought that this migration was permanent, and that their resettlement would be a final thing. So many of them imagined that they would always be able to return. And so we've always, you know, we tend to hear from people narrating these experiences that they wish they had the chance to visit their homeland or where they were born, but they just aren't able to do that now because of different visa restrictions or, you know, just the political strain between the different countries.
Right, and when we think about folks like Yogeshwar Sharma, who then made a third migration, right? Because all of these people, then these folks who we're hearing from who live in Illinois, then made another migration at a certain point here to the U.S. I wonder how much of the themes of those of people, you've been talking to people all over the world, what percentage of your stories are folks that have gone to Canada or the U.S. or Europe and are not still in the region?
Well, it's hard for me to give you a percentage, but we've recorded stories in about 22 different countries, in 22 different languages, in 12 different countries. We do interview many people in the South Asian diaspora across the world, whether it's in America or Europe, in different parts of the world. And what we do find is, the younger generation conducting the interviews are often very interested in learning about the histories which they haven't heard their families talk about, because there is a lot of silence surrounding partition in many families that experienced it. So we do, when talking to the diaspora, the younger and older generations, you know, it's an exciting project for many people living outside South Asia even today, because it lets them talk about something which they may not have spoken about in a very long time.
And the way that you do that, do you encourage then family members to interview each other and record it and give it to you?
Yes, we actually have an online oral history workshop, which is a free workshop, which anyone can attend anywhere. And we invite family members, the younger generation, to attend the workshop to interview members in their own family, like their grandmothers or grandfathers. And we find, you know, we often hear from the interviewers that this is a very enriching experience for many of them, because they get to learn a lot more about their family members than they may have known before.
And what do you think is lost if these stories aren't told, Rohini?
Well, for a long time, you know, like I mentioned before, the human impact of partition hasn't been studied and understood enough. The only way we can really understand, what people went through and what happened at the time to different people is through understanding the individual experiences. And this can only be done through this kind of intensive, oral history interview method. And if we don't record the stories now, you know, these interviewees, these partition witnesses are, you know, were born before 1947 and are in their 80s and 90s now. If we don't record the stories, they will be lost forever.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned that this is something that people get taught in school. I wonder what, for you personally, what you've learned about your own history and heritage through collecting these stories. Has it changed the way that you think about this historical event?
Absolutely. I think I learn something new every day from engaging with the interviews, and also by talking to other partition witnesses or the people conducting interviews. Um, we Well, we learned that, for one thing, you know, irrespective of what side of the border you came from or you currently are living on in the subcontinent, you know, the experiences, you know, we have these shared experiences which do unite us in a way, in the sense that, you know, everyone went through hardships. You know, everyone who was impacted by partition saw a lot of violence and went through hardships, which we need to remember and understand that, you know, it was something that affected a lot of people. And that's something which I think needs to come out a bit more. And also, one more thing that does stand out is you know, apart from the violence that people experienced and the brutality, the compassion that was shown by people, you know, the stories, for example, like in Sarabjit Randhawa's father's experience of being helped out by his helper at home, a Muslim helper. In the same way, we've heard numerous other stories of people being helped out, you know, being protected or, you know, given security by members of other religious groups. So that's something that does stand out as well.
Right. So not only the stories of Muslims and Hindus helping each other, but I guess also what you're saying is that no matter what side you ended up on, even though there's still such of a divide today, most people had very similar experiences.
Yes, absolutely.
And now, are you still looking for more people to take part in this project? Is it still possible for people to still record these?
Oh, definitely. We'd love to have more people sign up, and we do make it possible through the online oral history workshop that we have. It's a free workshop, and it trains you in the basic methods of conducting an oral history interview. We schedule them quite frequently. So anyone who wants to record stories with us is welcome to join the workshop. And anyone who wants to have their story recorded, you know, we have people writing to us all the time asking us to record their stories in different parts of the world. So we try and connect them with interviewers in their area to make it possible.
That's Rohini Ramkrishnan, Digital Archive Manager for the 1947 Partition Archive. I spoke with her back in the summer of 2017, and her oral history project is still going. So if you want to learn more, check out their website at 1947partitionarchive.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to this special edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The first African-American student at the University of Illinois enrolled in 1887. That's long before many other public universities in the U.S., especially in our southern states. But that doesn't mean life was easy, both back then and in the decades after. Black students weren't allowed to live in dorms and were often denied basic services in the towns of Champaign and Urbana. For many of those students, an African-American man named Albert Lee was a lifeline. He started working at the U of I in 1895, and for the next 50 years, he worked at the university, including as chief clerk of the U of I's president's office. During that time, he became known as the unofficial dean of African-American students for the work he did to advocate for Black students and connect them with resources they didn't have access to. Last summer, members of his family gathered at the University of Illinois to commemorate his life. Back then, I had a chance to speak with one of them. David Lee is Albert Lee's great-grandson. He works as a public health professional in L.A. Vanessa Ruyon is working on a biography and a documentary about Mr. Lee's life. She's an assistant professor of writing and rhetoric at James Madison University in Virginia. I asked Vanessa if she could start with the early days of Mr. Lee's career at the University of Illinois, starting in 1895.
Yeah, he was hired, he was employed as to be messenger at the president's office. This is President Draper. He started as a messenger, but he made himself indispensable to the office. And in only a few years, he was made a clerk, mostly because he was addressing correspondence and he was this dignified and trusted figure mediating on behalf of African American students. So he leveraged his own promotion very rightly so, I would say, by making the president notice that, well, if he's a messenger and it's the messenger signing particular letters, he needed a higher position. And that's how he started from clerk. And he, 52 years later, when he finally retired, he was the chief clerk and had been for several years.
And Vanessa, where did Mr. Lee, where was his where did he get his education? Did he grow up in Illinois?
He did. He was the son of a man who was made a slave in Kentucky, But Mr. Lee was born in the outskirts of Champaign on a farm. When he was a child, they moved to Champaign proper. So he graduated from Champaign High School, and he did 1 year, 1897 to 1898, of classes in general education, liberal arts at the university, but he didn't complete that. But he has always referred to himself as a self, he studied himself using the curriculum and the books that regular universities, regular students had to use.
David, I wonder what you knew of your great-grandfather growing up. I mean, certainly just his level of education, I would think, in the late 1890s was remarkable.
Yes, I had heard the stories about Albert R. Lee when I was growing up from my father, who told me different stories about how he worked at the University of Illinois and how many of my other family members were able to go to school there as a result of Albert R. Lee. My other great-grandfather, Forrest Anderson, who was a Black Oklahoma millionaire, sent his three daughters to the University of Illinois. And the story that was told to me was that Albert R. Lee helped my grandmother with her housing. It just so happened that Albert R. Lee had a young, handsome son living in the household. And so as a result, my grandfather had his bride put right under his nose. And that's how my grandparents came together.
Oh, so that's how your grandparents met. And your other great-grandfather, you said, was a millionaire in Oklahoma. This would have been in the early 1900s?
This was in the 1920s. He was an oil millionaire. And so he made sure that his three daughters got an education. And it was the University of Illinois that and the connection with Albert R. Lee that made that all possible.
And as David is talking, Vanessa, about how his grandmother received housing, how did what was that like? So Black students were allowed to be admitted to the university, but for example, they weren't allowed to live in the dorms.
Right. Housing, I would say, was dire for everybody, but especially for African Americans. And this is where Mr. Lee comes in. He was the mediator between the school and African-American families and Bethel families so that students could have a place to live, and they would cross the railroad tracks and come to classes. Now, there were restaurants on campus, and it was illegal to deny service. However, there were extra legal measures, I guess, and service was typically delayed. So students had to do, African-American students had to do the extra effort of go back to their host families, have their meals there, come back and continue with his classes.
Vanessa, it's such a remarkable life that we're thinking about. Mr. Lee, someone who, and I think it's an interesting story of, you know, for maybe African-American students legally were admitted to the University of Illinois, but then it sounds like there was obviously a lot of negotiation, a lot of difficulties in actually becoming students and being successful. How did you first hear about the story of Mr. Lee? How did you come across this?
Well, this was spring of 2009, and this was my second semester as a doctoral student at the Department of English. And I was taking a class, Race and Literacy, and we had to find evidence, archival pieces, primary texts documenting the transition of African Americans on campus. I had found other pieces. I had heard about Mr. Lee's papers, but the Archivist for Life and Culture made me notice his papers, and it's just one cubic feet, three boxes. I started exploring those boxes, and I just couldn't let go from then on. Everything that had to do with finishing my courses, my doctoral courses, had to do with Lee, with his church, and with African-American rhetoric.
And so Bethel was the church, the AME church here in Champaign-Urbana. How important, what role did the church play in helping students as well?
Very. It was a crucial role. As I, if you go through the families that hosted African American students, those are Bethel families. That was the church to go to. And it was Bethel families who accepted students, remodeled their houses as they could, and took them in. Bethel was also important because traditionally students form associations, and Mr. Lee directed one association for African American students so that they could practice, so that they could do rhetorical exercises. So Bethel was the site to be, the place of dignity and safety even.
We're talking to Vanessa Rouillon, who's working on a biography and a documentary about the life of Albert R. Lee, the unofficial dean of African American students at the University of Illinois. First started working at the U of I, as we're talking about, in 1895. His great-grandson, David Lee, is also with us on the line from L.A. Vanessa, how many students are we talking about? So when we think, I don't know what the population, the student population of the University of Illinois was like in the early 1900s or in the 1920s when David's grandparents met. How many Black students were there?
Not very many. Mr. Lee saw the school grow from 800 students to 18,000. But I don't have the figure with me right now, but I would say it was a small number. It was a small number of African American students.
Just sort of probably a handful of students, it sounds like, particularly in the early 1900s.
That's true. Mm-hmm. The visibility, they were not really that visible. There were not really very many, but they were there to advance their education.
And I wonder when we, as he started to become known as the unofficial dean of African American students, Vanessa, I wonder, did this ever get him into any trouble, whether it's with university officials or maybe local residents who didn't want to see Black students being educated?
No, I don't think so. I think he was very cautious. I think he understood the times he was living in. He was at times, in my work, I see him as perhaps not critical enough of the university. I think he understood. His ideology was mostly one of let the races interact. And they'll find one another not so different. So he was careful. I believe he was always careful, and I haven't encountered anything that might have yielded a reaction against his work. Not at all.
So Mr. Lee passed away in 1948. Is the university now maybe in a place where it's much more recognizing of the role that he played, and particularly the historical nature of the role that he played? I mean, certainly as we look back on people this year, I'm thinking even of the New York Times starting to run obituaries of prominent voices of people who passed away who were not recognized. Is it something similar to that, you think, what the university is doing now for Mr. Lee?
Yeah, I agree. I think it took me, I graduated 5 years ago, and it took me sort of 5 years to reach to the right people. But as we did, and we started planning for all of these memorial events, I see a commitment. I see goodwill in the university in actually remembering him and paying tribute to his work. Seems to me we tend to think that civil rights is just the 60s, and Mr. Lee did a lot of the work in those first, when he was alive, in those first 50 years of the 20th. He didn't have a headstone. We do have one now. He might have had one, but it's not clear. Vandalism in the 60s might be the result, but we have a nice headstone. It's on place. We are, for years, his markers have been these three archival boxes, but now we'll have one marker at the cemetery, one marker at the president's office, another plaque in Bethel, and
really remembering his history, Vanessa. Yeah. David, why do you think it's... Yeah, I wanted to ask David, why is it important for you that your great-grandfather's story isn't just preserved for your family, but shared widely with members of the public in the university community here?
Well, this is an example of an important historical figure who happened to be African-American. And, you know, up until this time, this story has never been really told. And so I think it's really important so we don't lose these stories of important African-Americans. You know, it also changed the trajectory of my life in different ways, in the fact that, you know, I had a great-grandfather who really valued education and made sure that my grandfather got an education. My grandfather had a bachelor's degree from the University of Illinois. Then my father had a bachelor's degree from University of Illinois. And so, you know, as a result, you know, education was stressed in my family, and I also have advanced degrees. And so that's how Albert R. Lee impacted my life. And I think that these stories need to be preserved and told so they don't get lost.
Well, thank you both for sharing these stories so our audience throughout the state and outside of the Champaign-Urbana area can hear the story of Albert R. Lee. I want to thank Vanessa Rouillon for being with us and bringing us a story, a biographer. She's a biographer and working on a documentary about Mr. Lee's life. David Lee is Albert R. Lee's great-grandson, also working in a university. He's the director of a public health program in South L.A. at Charles R. Drew University. Both of you, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That does it for us today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you want to search there for the 21st, you can like us, and it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, if you want to leave us a voicemail as well, send us an email, or remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows archived there. You can find us also most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21ST. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.